Welcome to a debate on the case for a creator. I'm Mark Sartori, pastor of Mountain View Alliance Church in Shelton, and I will be the moderator tonight. At the end of the debate tonight, we're going to be passing out a survey, and I won't say any more about that right now. Just for the sake of our own interest, we're interested in kind of the profile of people who attend this kind of thing. How many of you would consider yourselves to be theists? You believe in God or believe in a creator? And good number of you. How many consider yourselves to be full-blown Christians? Okay. How many of you would consider yourself to be an atheist? Small number. Yeah. We can have another debate, or an agnostic. Okay, another one back, one or two back there. Okay. Just a few comments before the debate begins. In our time, the growth of knowledge is exponential. Since 1970 or around up until 1970, the growth of knowledge would double every 20 years, by 2000 every 4 years, and the projection is that by 2010 it would double every 34 days. Double the knowledge available in 34 days. That's amazing. At my age, I'd be happy if my knowledge just plateaus, you know, without declining. But is there a correlation between knowledge and ultimate truth? The Bible describes men in later times as always learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Truth is simply what is, the way things are, and debating the way things are doesn't change what is. It seems to me that by being here tonight, we're acknowledging that there is such a thing as truth, because we have two men who are claiming particular points of view and attempting to prove their point of view right. And my guess is that both of them will defend their positions with a sort of religious fervor. A person may argue that there's no such thing as absolute truth, but even that is meant to be an absolutely true statement. In a truth debate like we're having tonight, truth will not be determined by which side is more intelligent or forceful and convincing or funny or witty or clever, because debating the way things are doesn't change what actually is. If it did, then a convincing atheist might win one debate and God would not exist. Or in another debate, a convincing theist might win and there would be God. God would exist. And so if there is such a thing as truth, and I believe there is, it will be truth regardless of what I happen to believe about it. So what's the point of this debate, or is there any point? Well, I believe there is. In fact, I hope there is, because what a person believes about his origin will inevitably condition his belief about his destiny. And I hope that the point here tonight is not simply to see our side win, because then we will leave exactly as we came. I think we need to come with an attitude of being willing to listen to what both sides are saying and trying to communicate. At any rate, this is what I would like to see tonight. First of all, I hope we can acknowledge right up front that there is intelligence and integrity on both sides of the question about a creator. Historically, people with incredible minds and penetrating intellects have landed on both sides of the question. So intelligence exists on both sides. And I hope there's integrity on both sides, meaning we believe what we believe honestly. And I hope that's true. That's not an excuse for believing something that's wrong or an error, but it's a good place to begin, because without integrity, we will cling defiantly to an idea, even if it becomes indefensible. When our worldview will not allow for any possibility outside of our personal biases, then we close our minds to what is, and ultimately end up as bigots, intolerant of any other view. The prof who automatically rules God out of the equation, and the religious prof who excludes even questions about evolution, both, in my opinion, have closed their minds and become bigots. And so I hope we're here tonight on an honest quest for truth. If I believe in God, and I simply know, I just know that He exists, I can still be on a quest because the God I believe in is way bigger and maybe even in a sense wilder than what my brain can wrap itself around. As a believer, there are issues that I wrestle with and things that my little brain can't figure out. Or, if you land on the atheist side or the agnostic side, I hope you are also on an honest quest. I hope you don't simply assume that what is must be explained in purely empirical terms, because that closes your mind to what might be the best and most logical interpretation of facts. I also hope tonight that we'll treat each other with respect and avoid strawman arguments. For example, a theist who paints all atheists as dark, sinister, self-centered people who have no concern or compassion for people fails to recognize the wide range of diversity among atheists. There is no single portrait of an atheist. By the same token, for an atheist to lump all theists into a hyper-rigid, judgmental stereotype misses the obvious fact that there is as much diversity within the faith as without. Or to assume creationists all embrace a young earth, let's say a 6,000-year-old universe, ignores those who accept evidence for intelligent design without setting parameters around its chronology. Finally, I want to suggest that to debate specific claims of Christianity or the Bible is beyond the range of this particular debate. That would be for another time, another place. Tonight, our focus is on the logic or illogic of the broad question of whether the universe is the product of chance or design. Tonight, we welcome Mr. Jim Corbett and Dr. Phil Fernandez. I want to tell you just a little bit about them. Jim Corbett is the go-to guy for the humanists of Washington. He received a BA in American Studies from Marist College, a master's in library science from the State University of New York at Albany. He also attended law school at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma. Jim Corbett, also known as Mr. Golf, started the golf etiquette website, MrGolf.com, is that right? In April 1996, and has co-authored The Golf Book for Kids. For the past 7 years, he's been involved with Golf Radio. The last 3 years as co-host of Tee It Up, Golf is Good Business. Tee It Up has been on KJR Sports Talk 950 in Seattle since July 2005. Jim authored the upcoming book, Life and the Meaning of Golf, which is currently being marketed by a literary agent. He currently works as a vice president of sales and marketing for courtsonline.net and has been in the online legal publishing business for over 25 years as vice president of business development. Jim is the creator of two educational children's board games marketed by Aristoplay, a well-known company in that market arena. Over the years, he has contributed many articles to Humanists of Washington newsletter and has been a member of the American Atheists and Humanists of Washington for many years. Dr. Phil Fernandez, president of the Institute of Biblical Defense, earned his Ph.D. in philosophy of religion from Greenwich University and an M.A. in religion from Liberty University. He has authored 5 books, including God, Government, and the Road to Tyranny, The God Who Sits Enthroned, Evidence for God's Existence, No Other Gods, A Defense of Biblical Christianity, Theism versus Atheism, The Internet Debate, and The Decay of a Nation. He is a member of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, the Evangelical Theological Society, and the Society of Christian Philosophers. Dr. Fernandez has lectured and debated on college campuses, including Princeton, University of North Carolina, and the University of Washington. He has debated some of America's leading atheists. I'm looking forward to this debate. I'm sure you are as well. And I want to just explain very quickly the format. We changed it just tonight a little bit. To begin with, each of you will have 20 minutes for your opening statements, and then 12 minutes each for your first rebuttal, and we're going to take a short break after that. Then you'll have 10 minutes each for a second rebuttal, 8 minutes for a third rebuttal, 5 minutes for closing remarks, and then we're going to allow actually quite a lot of time for some questions and answers, so you can be thinking or jotting down notes on questions or answers that you might have. And we're ready to begin. And which side wants to? Okay, Shin, you go first. I just wanted to mention that I'm going to be putting the sign up for them, and the only arbitrary part of this is if I don't like what they're saying, I'll hold it up sooner, or just hold this side up to begin with. So
I thought you were coming over here to tell me I now had 30 seconds.
You now have 30 seconds left.
Well, thank you for those wonderful opening remarks. And I'm sure that we will have an excellent evening here. And it was one of my great disappointments, of course, when I got here tonight and I met Phil, was that he turned out to be a terrific guy. And so that's going to take a lot of steam out of my arguments, but I'll try to stick with it here. I thank you all for coming, and it's great to see so many people who have an interest in this very important topic. And it's great to be doing this at a community college where there's a lot of young people who have an interest in this, because I think that's one of the great things about being young, is that you have to face these questions. You have your whole life ahead of you to face these important questions, and it's wonderful to think about them and think deeply about these important issues. I'm sure that as this evening goes on, we will get into deep detail about some of the age-old arguments about, you know, going back and forth about a creator, the things known as the cosmological arguments and the argument from design, argument from evil, and all these different things. And I'm not going to take my time at the beginning here to go through those. I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to get into those. What I would like to start out by talking about is a couple of experiences I've had recently. One is I have been in this conversation, this very conversation, with a couple of friends recently, friends who are Christians. I'm delighted, you know, to see in the audience that there are so many more people here from the Christian persuasion than otherwise, because I love talking to people who are Christians about this topic. I talk to people who are atheists all the time, and we all agree, so it's boring, you know. So this is much more interesting for me to talk to people who have a different perspective and to hear questions from people who have a different perspective. To me, that's the great challenge and the intellectual challenge of the whole thing, is to find places where we can agree, find places where we disagree, and come to understandings of one another's perspectives. But in these recent conversations I've had with friends who are Christians, we get into all these different issues about here's the cosmological argument and here's this argument and that argument, all these different intellectual exercises that we go through. And in these two recent conversations, both of them have pulled out turns out to be the ultimate trump card on me, which is I don't frankly care about the cosmological argument, and I don't care about the argument for design. I know there's a God because Jesus speaks to me. It's like, well, I can't really say much about that. You know, it's like, how can I argue against that? However, it occurs to me, you know, from my perspective, I think, well, how could that possibly be? You know, and, you know, so this woman that I work with, and we had a conversation, and she said, well, do you think I'm a liar? Well, no, I wouldn't suggest that you're a liar. And she said, well, do you think I'm a lunatic? It's like, well, no, there could be other choices, you know, besides those two. And it occurred to me, well, you know, perhaps you're mistaken. That's one other choice. And but I thought a lot about this. I thought, well, how could somebody be so misguided from, nothing, by the way, let me also say that I don't want to say anything here tonight specifically to offend anybody. That's not my mission or my goal here tonight, or to be rude or offensive. But I'm telling you things from my perspective, and hopefully we will share ideas. And so let me say a blanket statement at the beginning, that nothing that I say is intended specifically to offend you. If it does, I'm sorry about that, but that's what we're here to do, talk about our honest opinions about these subjects. So I wonder, how could anybody be so misguided as to believe that they're being spoken to by somebody who theoretically died 2,000 years ago? And it occurred to me, and so I thought of this in terms of, appropriately enough, a sort of a parable. And the parable that I thought of is the story of the emperor's new clothes. Is everybody here familiar with the story of the emperor's new clothes? It's a classic Hans Christian Andersen story, right? And so you know that the emperor is fooled into believing that he's wearing these beautiful clothes that were made for him, and he walks out into the community, essentially, basically stark naked, but believing that he's clothed in these beautiful clothes, right? And you think to yourself, well, how could the emperor be so fooled like that, right? So I'm going to read just a brief thing from the beginning of the story, because you all know how it ends. But most people know the story without ever having read this story, because we know of the tale, basically. So I'm just going to read here briefly. Once upon a time, there lived a vain emperor whose only worry in life was to dress in elegant clothes. He changed clothes almost every hour and loved to show them off to his people. Word of the emperor's refined habits spread over his kingdom and beyond. Two scoundrels who had heard of the emperor's vanity decided to take advantage of it. They introduced themselves at the gate of the palace with a scheme in mind. "We are two very good tailors, and after many years of research, we have invented an extraordinary method to weave a cloth so light and fine that it looks invisible. As a matter of fact, it is invisible to anyone too stupid and incompetent to appreciate its quality." Okay, that's the only part I want to read. That's the essence of the story right there. He set up two things, right? The scoundrels have set up two things. One, playing on the weakness of the emperor. We know what the emperor loves and what the emperor really wants, right? And two, we're going to set this up so that anybody who doesn't believe what we're pitching here will be labeled as stupid and incompetent. And to me, this is a great parable for religion, because religion preys upon the thing that people want the most, which is life after death, right? This is the weakness of humanity, is we die. And so it preys upon our weakness. And then it tells us that anybody who doesn't believe this is too stupid and incompetent to understand what's going on. Does religion tell us that anybody who doesn't believe this is stupid? Is there any place where they tell us that? Yes. Psalm 14, verse 1. "The fool in his heart believes there is no God." And then it goes on and on. "They do abominable acts. They do terrible things. These are the worst people in the world. They're awful. And if you don't believe in God, you're just like them." So they prey on your weakness, that's P-R-E-Y, and they set you up for being a fool if you don't believe this. Okay? So why does the emperor get fooled? Because he wants to be fooled. More than anything else, he wants to believe this. And so he goes so far as to humiliate himself. And again, from my interpretation of this, this is just like religion. People want to dress in the raiments, the beautiful raiments in the afterworld, and wear the golden slippers, you know, so the metaphor is kind of tortured there a little bit. But they want to wear the beautiful clothes of a heavenly garment and so on. That's what they want. And again, we set it up so that they're fools if they don't. But it's because people want to be fooled. There's nobody who's easier to be fooled than a person who wants you to fool them. So keep that in mind. I think that's going to come up over and over and over again tonight, because that is the essence of religion. I have an aunt who is a very devout religious person, as virtually everybody else in my family is. I'm the only wayward soul, so to speak. And I've had many, many discussions with this aunt of mine, and of course she's very frustrated by the time we're all done, but she has told me on several occasions that when it comes right down to it, again, these arguments of cosmological and intellectual this and intellectual that don't really matter. What it comes down to is, in her estimation, faith is a gift. Faith is a gift, and you have to have that gift, or else you just don't get it, you know? And I thought about that a lot, and at one point it occurred to me, faith is not a gift. Faith is a curse. Faith is something that, anything that encourages you to shut off your mind and stop thinking is not a gift. That is a curse. Look at all of humanity out there right now. What is the greatest plague that we have in humanity? It's ignorance. That is the greatest sin in the world, is ignorance. I don't believe in sin in the classical sense, but I do believe that sin, or ignorance, is a type of sin, a metaphorical sin that just plagues humanity and always has. And of course, again, from my perspective, this is perpetuated by religion. And then I thought, well, faith, in a way, I can see that faith is a gift, but I again, twist this metaphor around such that faith is a gift, but it's not a gift that you receive. Faith is a gift that you, the faithful, give to your pastors and leaders and so on, which says, just lead me anywhere you want to go. I'm in. Count me in. Here, I'm, you know, as they say in Texas Hold'em, I'm all in, right? Just whatever you want to do with me, that's fine. I have faith. I'm not going to think. I'm never going to question what you say. I'm just, lead me along wherever you want me to go. And it sure makes that job a lot easier when everybody's running around saying, just tell me what you want me to believe and I'll believe it. So what I'm hoping that we'll do tonight, and again, I thank Mark for setting this, the scene for this, is that we will use our rational, you know, senses to think. And I'm not here. I don't have a mission, as Christians do from their Bible. I don't have a mission to go out and make converts of all the world. So it's not my role here tonight, or my goal here tonight, to try to convert anybody to my way of thinking. But as a person, I do like to challenge people to think and to question your own assumptions. That's how you grow as a person. You question your own assumptions. And everybody here, with a few brief, you know, minor exceptions, has come here with assumptions that Jesus is God, Jesus rose from the dead, all these different things, and this Creator exists, and that's why we're here. This whole world is here for our benefit, and it was put here, you know, for our glory and all. Those are assumptions that I think need to be challenged. And hopefully tonight we'll be able to do that. I'm here representing the humanists of Washington. The label that here representing the atheistic perspective. To me, atheism is a label that has, unfortunately, bears a lot of negative connotations because people of religion have grown to hate people who are atheists. You know, we are sort of, in a way, a sort of a threat, I guess, that because it challenges your underlying beliefs. Atheism, to me, is a sort of a passive position. It just says, I don't believe that there's a God. But I'm also here for the humanists of Washington. And the humanism is a very positive and very active position, which says, I believe that since there is no God, that human beings are responsible for their own fate, that we have to be proactive, we have to work together, we have to act as if we are in a community, because we are in a community. And I've been in a few debates sponsored by Rand and Thought Life before, and I always like to stress the idea that my philosophy of life is, if I make the world a better place for you, it automatically becomes a better place for me. If I can do everything I can to make this world better for you, then I get to live in a better world, and hopefully you'll do the same thing for me. And so humanism secular humanism, which again has gotten just, it just gets beat up because Christians and theists, you know, hate that idea. But it is a very positive world perspective or world view, and it greatly respects the dignity of humanity and the purpose and point of, well, I wouldn't say purpose in the way you're thinking of it, but the goals and the roles of human beings working together in this fragile little planet in which we live, it's a very important and a very positive worldview. And I hope that, if nothing else, that you might walk out of here tonight with a different appreciation of that worldview and of that perspective, so that we can all get along a little bit better. And that I'll just conclude that as my opening comments, and thank you very much. I'm looking forward to a fun evening.
Well, I would like to express my gratitude for Rand Wagner for arranging this debate, and Jim Corbett for agreeing to debate me. I've only known Jim now for, about half an hour or so, and I've really grown to like him. The first thing that struck me out about his name was, you know, I'm a boxing fan. I used to box back in Jersey, and Jim Corbett, you know, when I did a search on his name, all I was getting was Gentleman Jim Corbett, the boxer who took the title from John L. Sullivan before any of us were born. And but as I got to meet him and hear him right now, I could see that he is truly a gentleman, and I appreciate that, so we can have an intelligent exchange of ideas. Now, tonight I've chosen to utilize a cumulative case for God. This cumulative case will examine several aspects of human experience that are more adequately explained by theism, the belief in a personal God, than by atheism, the rejection of a belief in a personal God. The thesis I seek to defend is as follows. It is more reasonable to be a theist than it is to be an atheist. So I'm not trying to prove theism beyond all reasonable doubt. I'm just trying to show that theism, belief in God, is more reasonable than atheism. For purposes of this debate, I will define God as the eternal, uncaused cause of all else that exists. This being is personal, i.e. a moral and intelligent being, and unlimited in all his attributes. This being is separate from his creation, transcendent, but he is also involved with it, immanent. In short, I will argue that the God of theism exists. Now, my first argument is from the beginning of the universe. The argument is as follows. Whatever began to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe had a cause. Premise number one uses the law of causality. Non-being cannot cause being. In other words, nothing, from nothing, nothing comes. Nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing. Hence, whatever began to exist needs a cause for its existence. Premise number two contends that the universe had a beginning. Scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe includes the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration, and the Big Bang model. The second law of thermodynamics is one of the most firmly established laws of modern science. It states that the amount of usable energy in a closed system is running down. This means that someday in the finite future, all the energy in the universe will be useless unless there is intervention from outside the universe. In other words, if left to itself, the universe will have an end. But if the universe is going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. At one time in the finite past, all the energy in the universe was usable. Since the universe is winding down, it must have been wound up. The universe is not eternal. It had a beginning. Since it had a beginning, it needs a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. It should also be noted that due to energy deterioration, if the universe is eternal, it would have reached the state of equilibrium in which no change is possible an infinite amount of time ago. All of the universe's energy would already have been used up. Obviously, this is not the case. Therefore, the universe had a beginning. The Big Bang model also indicates that the universe had a beginning. In 1929, astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding at the same rate in all directions. As time moves forward, the universe is growing apart. But this means that if we go back in time, the physical universe would get smaller and smaller. Eventually, if we go back far enough in the past, the entire universe would be what scientists call a point of infinite density or a point of dimensionless space. However, if something physical is infinitely dense, it is non-existent, for material things can only be finitely small. The same could be said for points of dimensionless space. If a supposed physical point has no dimensions, it is non-existent, for it takes up no space. Therefore, if the Big Bang model is correct, it shows that the universe began out of nothing a finite time ago. Now, it seems obvious to me that the principle of causality is more plausible than the absurd belief that things can pop into existence from nothing totally without a cause. Non-being cannot cause being. Since the universe had a beginning, it needs a cause. Besides the scientific evidence, there is also philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe. For if the universe is eternal, then there would be an actual infinite number of past events in time. However, it is impossible to traverse or pass through an actual infinite set of points. Zeno's paradoxes have shown that. If the universe is eternal, it would be impossible to reach the present moment, for one would have to traverse an actual infinite set of moments to reach the present moment. Since the present moment has been reached, there cannot be an actual infinite set of events in the past. There could only be a finite number. Therefore, there had to be a first event. The universe had a beginning. Since the universe had to have a beginning, it had to have a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. Also, there could not be an infinite number of causes and effects in the past, for then the present effect, the universe, would not have been actualized. Again, an actual infinite set cannot be traversed. Therefore, there had to be a first uncaused cause of the universe. This uncaused cause would be eternal, without beginning or end. Only eternal and uncaused existence can ground the existence of the universe. Several attributes of the uncaused cause of the universe can be discovered through examination of the universe. This debate, hopefully, is evidence that intelligent life exists in the universe. Since intelligence is a perfection found in the universe, the ultimate cause of the universe must also be an intelligent being, for intelligence cannot come from non-intelligence. No one has ever shown how intelligence could evolve from mindless nature. Morality also exists in the universe, for without morality, there would be no such thing as right and wrong. However, the moral judgments we make show that we do believe there are such things as right and wrong. Still, nature is non-moral. No one holds a rock morally responsible for tripping him. There is no way that mere molecules in motion could produce moral values. Since nature is non-moral, but morality exists in the universe, the cause of the universe must be a moral being. Therefore, the uncaused cause of the universe must be an intelligent moral being. This means that God must be a personal being. My second argument is the continuing existence of the universe. Experience shows us that limited dependent beings exist. These limited dependent beings need other beings for their continued existence. For example, I depend on air, water, and food to sustain my existence. However, adding limited dependent beings will never give us an independent and unlimited whole. Therefore, the sum total of limited dependent beings is itself limited and dependent. If each individual part of a floor is wood, then the whole floor will be wood. Likewise, if each part of the universe is dependent, then the entire universe is dependent. Hence, the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of all limited dependent beings must be unlimited and independent. There cannot be two or more unlimited and independent beings, since if there were, they would limit one another's existence, but then they would not be unlimited. Therefore, there can only be one unlimited and independent being. This being must have all its attributes in an unlimited way, otherwise it could not be an unlimited being. The being must be all-powerful, for he is the source of all the power in the universe. No other power can limit him. He is eternal, for he is not limited by time. He is everywhere present, since he is not limited by space. He is immaterial, since he is not limited by matter. This being must be all good, since he is not limited by evil. He must also be all-knowing, since he is not limited by ignorance. Now, since mindless nature works towards goals, such as acorns always becoming oak trees and not something else, there must be an intelligent designer overseeing natural processes. Without intelligent design, nature's processes would be left to chance. There would be no orderly patterns that could be described as natural laws. Therefore, this infinite and independent being, whom all finite and dependent beings depend upon for their continued existence, must be an intelligent being. Argument number 3, the design and order found in the universe. The order, design, and complexity found in the universe strongly imply that the universe is not a random, chaotic throwing together of atoms. Rather, it is the product of intelligent design. And as the product of intelligent design, it necessitates the existence of an intelligent designer. Contemporary scientists have found numerous evidences for design in the universe. A few examples will suffice. First, the slightest variation in the expansion rate of the universe would render the universe incapable of sustaining life. Second, British scientists Hoyle and McGramison estimated that the chances of life evolving from the random shuffling of organic molecules is virtually zero. They calculated that there is only one chance in 10 to the 20th power to form a single enzyme, and just one chance in 10 to the 40,000th power to produce the approximately 2,000 enzymes that exist. However, Hoyle and McGramison point out that the production of enzymes is only one step in the generation of life. Therefore, they concluded there must be some type of cosmic intelligence to explain the origin of life. Hoyle compared the probability of life spontaneously generating from non-life as equivalent to the chances of a tornado randomly producing a Boeing 747 from a junkyard. The cell is the basic unit of life. A single-celled animal contains enough genetic information to fill 30,000 volumes of encyclopedia. An explosion in a print shop will never produce even one volume of encyclopedia. That amount of information necessitates an intelligent cause. Also, the human brain contains more genetic information than the information found in the world's largest libraries. There is no way that this amount of information could be produced by mere chance. Intelligent intervention is needed. Third, astrophysicist Hugh Ross listed 25 narrowly defined parameters that the universe had to have in order for life to be possible. Ross also pointed out 32 narrowly defined parameters for life concerning the Earth, its moon, its sun, and its galaxy. For instance, if the distance between the Earth and the sun was to differ by just 2% in either direction, no life on Earth would be possible. These parameters for life on Earth clearly show evidence of design and purpose. Fourth, molecular biologist Michael Behe has shown that the irreducible complexity found on the molecular level cannot be explained by the atheistic evolutionary model. Intelligent design is the only adequate explanation. The theistic hypothesis of intelligent design is obviously more plausible than the atheistic hypothesis of random chance. My fourth argument, the existence of absolute moral values. We all make moral value judgments when we call the actions of another person wrong. When we do this, we appeal to a moral law. This moral law could not originate with each individual, for then we could not call the actions of another person, such as Adolf Hitler, wrong. The moral law is not a creation of each society, for then one society cannot call the actions of another society, such as Nazi Germany, wrong. The moral law does not come from a world consensus, for world consensus is often mistaken. The world once thought the earth was flat, the sun revolved around the earth, and slavery was morally acceptable. Appealing to society or world consensus will never give us an adequate cause for the moral law and the moral judgments we make. Appealing to society or world consensus only quantitatively adds men and women. What we need is a moral law qualitatively above man. This moral law must be eternal and unchanging so that we can condemn the actions of the past, slavery, the Holocaust, etc. The moral law qualitatively above man is not descriptive of the way things are, as is the case with natural laws. The moral law must be prescriptive. It prescribes the way things ought to be. Prescriptive laws need a prescriber. Therefore, a moral lawgiver must exist, and this lawgiver must be eternal and unchanging. Argument number 5, the absurdity of life without God. What hope can an atheist offer mankind? People on their deathbeds don't usually call an atheist to comfort them. Normally, a preacher or priest is summoned. Even if an atheist could guarantee us 70 years of happiness, what good would that be when compared with the eternity of non-existence that follows? If there is no God, then Hitler will not be punished for his evil deeds, and Mother Teresa will not be rewarded for her generous works of charity. If there is no God, then a million years from now, it would make no difference if you were a Hitler or a Mother Teresa. Can life have any ultimate meaning if there is no God? If non-existence is what awaits us, can we really make sense of life? You live, and then you die. There are no eternal consequences. Hitler and Mother Teresa have the same destiny. We all finish our meaningless journeys in total nothingness. The famous atheist Bertrand Russell wrote that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction and the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Immediately following that statement, Russell referred to his atheistic philosophy as the firm foundation of unyielding despair. Without God, life is without meaning. However, if there is a God, then there is hope. The God of the Bible guarantees the defeat of evil and the triumph of good. He guarantees that Hitler will receive his punishment and Mother Teresa will receive her reward. God gives life meaning, for how we choose to live our lives on earth brings eternal consequences. God is our reason to be optimistic about the future. Only He can overcome our fear of death. Only He can defeat evil. Without God, meaningless existence is all we face. Without God, there is no hope. And my sixth and final argument, the failure of atheism. I have shown that atheism cannot adequately explain the beginning of the universe, its continuing existence, the design found in the universe, or the existence of absolute moral laws. Atheism cannot give meaning to life. But there are more problems for atheism, for it cannot adequately explain the laws of logic and mathematics, though both are needed for scientific investigation to begin. Atheism has no way to justify the sanctity of human life. It cannot offer a plausible explanation for human free will and human responsibility. Atheism has no way to justify the concept of human rights. Human rights are either God-given and inalienable, or they are man-made and arbitrary. If God does not exist, then human government becomes the giver of human rights, and it can take away these rights at will. When governments replace God as the ultimate authority, then tyranny and bloodshed inevitably follow. For human beings to be held morally responsible for their actions, they must have free will. But to have free will, human actions cannot be biologically determined. To truly be free, man must have a soul. But this makes more sense in a theistic world than in a world without God. In conclusion, theism is more reasonable than atheism. Atheism either tries to explain away the aspects of reality we have discussed, or it acknowledges these aspects of reality but says they are just there. Atheism becomes either an explaining away of the evidence or a total non-explanation, whereas theism offers a reasonable explanation of the evidence. Hence, theism is more reasonable than atheism. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. That was great. Well, I have 12 minutes, I think, is that correct, to respond to a 20-minute presentation. So I'm going to have to go real fast here. So let me just kind of whip through some of these if I can. Phil started out with the cosmological argument, which is whatever began to exist had a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe had a cause. I have at least six things that are wrong with this. Let's start and go through them real fast. So I hope you're taking notes here. First off, this is not a correct syllogism. Okay? It's set up as an incorrect, illogical syllogism. The universe is the set of all things. A set cannot be a member of itself. Okay? So from a mathematical, syllogistic standpoint, it doesn't work. So therefore, the A and B points of this are invalid. They can cancel one another out. It would be like saying every man who exists has a mother. The human race encompasses all men. Therefore, the human race has a mother. Well, that doesn't work, right? It's not logical. It doesn't work. So the syllogism to begin with is wrong. Secondly, the assumption is that God is the uncaused cause. Okay? If God can exist uncaused, then we are acknowledging that something can exist uncaused. There is something out there that can exist uncaused. Well, if God can exist uncaused, then why couldn't the universe exist uncaused? What caused God? You know, so and then there's the argument against it, which is called the God of the gaps, which is, and this will come up throughout this discussion, which is that any time we don't understand something, we plug in God. That's always the answer. And it sort of reminds me of there was an old Far Side cartoon of two scientists standing in front of a blackboard, and they've got this gigantic formula strewn across the whole blackboard, and the one guy was pointing to one spot and he says, and a miracle occurs right here. And so, you know, it's whenever you can't explain, you just figure, well, that's God right there. So that's a problem with that analogy. Another thing is cosmological advances. We are making remarkable strides in scientific developments, in particles, quarks, and research that shows that quarks may come in and out of existence randomly, and quarks were only discovered in 1964, so it's like 30 years, 40 years. And this is brand new science. We're still learning this. We have to have a chance to figure out what's going on with this. Dr. Alan Guth, who developed the theory of cosmic inflation and has written several books on this topic, I actually spoke with him on the phone in the last week to talk to him about his work and some of the things that are going on. And they are making remarkable discoveries. As Mark pointed out in the opening comments, our knowledge and our ability to acquire knowledge is growing exponentially. And this is one of those areas in cosmology and in biology and so on. We are learning so much as time goes on. We can't afford to just say, well, we're just going to attribute that all to God. We have to leave the door open to new knowledge and new understanding of the universe in which we live. It's just too convenient to just say, oh, that's God. Let's not go there. But Dr. Guth has a statement that he wrote in one of his articles, which says, 2,000 years after Lucretius proclaimed that nothing can be created from nothing, inflationary cosmology asserts that he was wrong. By the way, Dr. Guth is the head astrophysicist at MIT. I should point that out. He's not exactly what you call a slacker. This guy is, he's the one who discovered this new theory of, which enhances our understanding of what happened at the Big Bang. This guy is intimately involved in this. He knows a little bit about what's going on. He's intimately involved in this research, and he is ready to proclaim that this idea of nothing can come from nothing may have been a little premature. We have done this, as humans, we've done this over and over and over again. Actually, Phil referred to a couple of these instances. We believe the Earth was flat because we looked around and we see it looks pretty flat from here. Okay, so it must be flat. We looked up in the sky and we see that the sun comes up over there and goes around there, so the Earth must be the center of the universe. It was all put here for us, and so we obviously must be the center. But turns out we were wrong about that. Galileo almost sacrificed his life for that exact principle. So we leap to conclusions based on evidence that seems logical, based on early observations, but often it proves worthwhile to wait until all the information is in. And we may not know the answer to these questions for 100 years, but if that's the right answer, then it's worth waiting for. So let's not just plug in God every time we have a question that we don't understand. Another comment on this, and it's related to what I just said, is the only really honest answer to the question of where did the universe come from, how was it formed, how did it start, the only honest answer is, I don't know. And it's okay to not know. We don't have to plug in magical answers because we don't have the information right now today. It's our responsibility to continue to learn and grow. And just one more that I just jotted down while I was listening there was that even if the universe had a cause, and we don't know what it is, but I would assert it could not possibly be this God of the Bible, because the Bible is so fraught with mistakes, contradictions, inconsistencies, that it's a creation myth, just like the creation myth of the Egyptians and the Hawaiian Islanders and the Native Americans. It's a good story. It's a really good story. But it's a creation myth like all other creation myths. And let's not attach more importance, scientific credibility, to a creation myth. Okay, that was his first point. The second point, dependent beings require an independent being for existence. Says who? Why do we have to have an independent being to create dependent beings? Natural selection, evolution, and the power of natural selection explains every aspect of life, the complexity of life, the wide variety of life. Natural selection is an incredibly powerful tool that acts in accord with the laws of nature. It just happens. It doesn't happen with an intellectual purpose to say, my goal is to go out and create human beings at the end of this process. It just happens. And we happen to be the wonderful end product of that. Let's appreciate that and do with it what we can. But it doesn't mean that there has to be. There's no rule around that says you have to have an independent being to rule over these dependent beings. Yes, but and more importantly, and again, from my humanist perspective, instead of trying to prove that a phantom being is responsible for all this, let's recognize that we are dependent. What are we dependent upon? We're dependent upon one another. Let's understand that the best way for us to survive, to grow, and to continue to develop is to form a cohesive community of people and be dependent, but be dependent on one another. That's the best way for us to grow, and that is the essence of secular humanism. It's a very positive life force. The argument from design, I was saying to Mark earlier, I could do a whole night on the argument from design. This is the most absurd claim to come around the bend in a long time. And it's been around the bend a couple of times. I mean, it was first proclaimed, back in the days of Aristotle. It was later perpetuated by William Haley around 1802. But when Darwin came out with the natural selection and evolution in 1849, the design argument pretty much went away. It's come back now for one reason, and that is to do an end-around run against the U.S. Constitution, which says you can't teach religion in the schools. So they're trying to dress up this pig as something special and calling it science and put it into the classrooms. And that is nothing short of an attempt at an end-around run. I'm going to just grab my little show-and-tell item here. This is the cover of Time magazine from a year ago, February 2006. Is America flunking science? And the answer, as you go through here, is yes, we are. And the reason we're flunking science is because there's so many places that want to teach religion as science. There are three articles that I have here that are written by none other than Newt Gingrich, an arch-conservative politician. Not a guy that I quote very often, and not a guy that we consider ourselves on the same team very often. But let me see here. I have there's some quotes here that I have from there. Okay. The faith. This is a quote. I'll leave these on the stage. Anybody that wants them can have them. They're on the internet. You can go get them easily enough. The fate of our country may well depend on whether or not science recognizes that they have real responsibilities as citizens. The first time in human history, knowledge is exponentially with computers, biology, growth of knowledge, multiplying in a way it never has before, never before in the age of the railroad and the airplane and the automobile. We are, as Mark pointed out accurately, our knowledge is growing exponentially. The rest of the world is running right by us. Newt Gingrich says that is a national security risk. So you can look at this question and say, do you love your country? If you love your country and you want it to still be a leader in the world 25 years from now as this information grows, you better check yourself on whether or not you should be teaching creationism in the science classroom. It is a joke. It is, and again, I can get a little worked up over this one, but this is a national disgrace. And people that perpetuate and push this should really, quite honestly, be ashamed. Design is not science. Okay. I remember. Okay, I've got a whole bunch of these things here. Let me jump to the moral argument here, the existence of absolute moral values, and I'm not going to get all this in because I've got two pages of notes on this. But the implication is that with atheism, morality is, there's nothing more Darwinian than morality. We are moral beings because we evolved to be moral beings. There's nothing that's better for a community, a strong community, than a strong moral code. There are scientific studies on animals that prove that chimpanzees have a sort of moral code. They treat one another well. They treat their family members better than they treat their neighbors. There's lots of scientific evidence that proves that morality is Darwin in action. We are moral societies because the moral societies survive and go on to perpetuate themselves. But the implication is that religion can offer you absolute, unchanging moral values. Phil mentioned slavery as an example. Is slavery an absolute, are we all in agreement that slavery is a reprehensible thing? Of course we would be, right? But what does the Bible say about slavery? Leviticus says, you should buy your slaves in the neighboring country, not in your own country. And if you have sexual relations with your slaves, you know, here's the way that happens. Here's the rule on how that happens. I'm actually thinking that this whole thing of buying your slaves in a neighboring country is not a bad idea. I'm thinking of Canada myself. And, you know, have you ever been up there? They're nice people, you know. And I think we should go up there, we'll get a bus, and we'll go up and buy some slaves. Leviticus also says you should hand your slaves down to your children so that they can be your slaves perpetually. This is the absolute unchanging moral value that we learn. In the 16, 17, and 1800s in the South, in the United States, slaveholders used these sections of the Bible to justify their moral values of slavery. Is it limited to the Old Testament? No. Actually, Paul tells people in the Bible, in Timothy, a letter to Timothy, how slaves should be managed and so on. So slavery is okay, according to the Bible. What about, you know, I'm sure I'm out of time. Okay, I'll have to do that. Thank you.
Okay, first I'd like to just mention that I really appreciated the amount of respect that that Jim gives to Christians. And he mentioned early on in his opening statement that traditional arguments, he didn't really think that most Christians consider them important enough. Well, it's really got nothing to do with this debate. He talked about subjective Christians who don't care about evidence. That's really not important about this debate. In fact, everybody here apparently cares about evidence. Jim cares about evidence. I care about evidence. So whoever these subjective Christians are, we would both disagree with them. But he talked about the emperor's new clothes. The emperor believes that he's not naked, and everybody else knows that he's naked. Well, in that point, he was talking about anybody who, you know, some Christians believe that anybody who disagrees with Christians is stupid. Well, I disagree with that. In Psalm 114, verse 1, which says, the fool has said in his heart there is no God. When the Bible uses the word, whether it's in the Hebrew Old Testament or the Greek New Testament, the word fool there is a moral fool. It's someone who's making a bad choice because God does exist. That's what the Bible's saying. It's not calling the person non-intelligent in any way. Definitely not the way we use the word often today. He says that we want to be fooled about life after death, and that's why we become Christians. I would tend to agree more with Blaise Pascal than with what Jim is saying there. Blaise Pascal, by the way, didn't like traditional arguments, so he would be in agreement with Jim on that. But he said this: imagine yourself, this is in his Ponce, still in print to this day, you can buy it at Barnes & Noble, imagine yourself in line. One person after another is being executed, and you know that your number is coming up. And then Pascal says, this is the human condition. Later on, he talks about the final act is gruesome. They throw dirt over your head, and it's over. Pascal talks about the fact that we all know, we come into existence, and we find out real quick in life that we're going to die. Someday we're going to attend our own funeral. And so what do? Says Pascal. He says, we go dancing. We divert our attention. Pascal says, like we're running towards the edge of a cliff, and we hold our hands over our eyes so we don't see it the whole way. So I would actually argue that the fact that we, you know, that somehow humans think about eternity, we think about life after death, is it there, that ought to cause us to look for it. This is why Blaise Pascal said there's only two kinds of persons that he would classify as wise. Those who seek God with all their hearts because they don't know him, and those who serve him with all their hearts because they do know him. And Pascal was just saying that basically the wise man is going to seek for God just based on the possibility that God exists, because death is our biggest enemy. We're not talking, you know, wishful thinking or wanting to be fooled. Death is a real enemy. Real enemies need real solutions, okay? And so he said, faith makes you shut off your mind and stop thinking. And then he says, ignorance is a metaphor for sin. That's what we're debating. He's assuming what he's supposed to prove, okay? He implies that that theists are anti-intellectual. Most of the greatest philosophers throughout the history of philosophy have believed in some type of God. A great many of them were theists who believed in a personal God. He says that many people of religion have grown to hate atheists. I certainly hope that's not the case with anybody here. Certainly it's not the case with myself. And I know Rand doesn't hold that position either. But he says that atheism is a pacifist position. Hey, let me tell you, I'm sure he can dig up some dirt on the tens of thousands that were killed by the Roman Catholic form of Christianity, and even the Protestant form of Christianity with the Salem witch hunts and all. But the fact of the matter is, atheism is not always a pacifist position. I know he'll try to distance himself from the red Chinese communists and from the Soviet Union, but the fact of the matter is, those two countries alone, putting their ideology to work, have slaughtered more human beings than all the human beings killed in mankind's wars put together. Okay? In some of these communist regimes, the death rate is higher during times of peacetime. At least during times of war, they arm their people so they can defend themselves. Whatever the case, he says he wants to make the world a better place to live. What does Jim mean by better? Better means that there's something bad, and there's something better than that, and there's something better than that, and there's something best. Different degrees of goodness. That makes no sense. You see, he's living on borrowed capital from the Christian worldview. The atheist bank account doesn't have anything for moral values, for absolute moral values. They can't call anything better or best without acting like a Christian. Okay? So many people reject the Christian worldview, but then they have to talk like Christians or act like Christians to make sense of the world in which we live, because the only world that's out there is the one God created. Jim assumes absolute truth. I mean, he assumes that our position, the theist position, is false. The atheistic position is true. He's assuming absolute truth. Where did it come from? Did absolute truth evolve from primordial soup? How much does absolute truth weigh? What color is absolute truth? Can you bounce it? Okay? I just can't see non-material truths evolving from primordial soup or from matter. He rejects my cosmological argument. I can't touch on all the points here, but he says, if God could be uncaused, then so could the universe. Yeah, but it's not. And he does. I'm not even sure he believes the universe is uncaused. I mean, atheists used to argue in the early 20th century and the late 18th century or the late 19th century. They used to argue the universe doesn't need a cause because it's always been here. The universe is eternal. Then came Big Bang cosmology, and now atheists like Quentin Smith, some of America's leading atheists from, I believe, Michigan State University. Dr. Michael Martin, whom I debated, from Boston University. Both of these gentlemen in print say that the universe basically just popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause. So, I mean, on that basis alone, I would side with theism. Because to me, in the beginning, God created the universe sounds a lot more reasonable than in the beginning, nothing produced the universe. It just popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. The atheist 100 years ago would never argue that the universe has popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause. That's something new. He talks about the God of the gaps. Oh, and by the way, we're not arguing, you know, if God could be uncaused, well, so could the universe. But nobody's arguing the universe is eternal. Everybody acknowledges the universe has a beginning. If something has a beginning, it needs a cause. He talks about the God of the gaps. We don't understand something. We just place God in the gap. Hey, I would argue that atheists, I think we could both be guilty of this. I mean, in ancient times, maybe some people thought, well, earthquakes and stuff, the gods are angry and all. But what about atheists placing chance in the gaps? If we don't know the answer, let's just put in chance. Well, it happened by chance. And he's talking about design, that this isn't a big, strong argument for God. Let me tell you, I'll come out of the closet right now. I'm an Oakland Raider fan. That's, you know, we didn't get the ring this year. At least we got the first round draft pick, but knowing Al Davis will probably trade that away. But whatever the case, if we were playing Scrabble right now, okay, and you left the room for 5 minutes and you came back and on the table it said, Raiders rule, Seahawks stink, okay, you're not gonna say, well, you know, that probably wasn't Phil who did that, or, you know, it just kind of happened by chance. But let me tell you, when you deal with a single-celled animal, 30,000 volumes of encyclopedia, that's a lot more information than Raiders rule, Seahawks stink. And when we see, just a small, I mean, he says that, Jim says that there's no place in science for design. What is he talking about? What about archaeology? You find an arrowhead, you don't just think, wow, weird-shaped rock. No, you know that intelligence molded that arrowhead and designed it to be what it is. We can recognize design. Okay? Big Bang. They're getting away from it. Scientists used to view it as an explosion. It just exploded all the order and all the complexity that we see in the world today. And I guess as evolution moves forward, it's producing more order, more complexity. No. Explosions take things from a state of order and complexity to a state of disorder. Just look at the Oklahoma City building after it was bombed. It only goes in one direction. So how can that be a scientific statement? Order, we don't go from chaos to order without intelligent intervention. This is not plugging God in the gaps because of something we don't know. This is putting God there because of something we do know. Design is evidence for God. He mentions quantum physics, that particles come into existence out of nothing. Let me tell you, it's called quantum tunneling. No, there's no two quantum physicists agree what is going on out there. And whatever the case, quantum events are space and time dependent. If we're talking about the universe popping into existence totally out of nothing, there's no space, no time, no matter, no energy, no rules of quantum physics, okay? It's not an entity which has an equal amount of positive and negative properties. Many physicists do not believe that these particles are popping into existence out of nothing. All Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy says is that basically the subatomic particle movement is presently unpredictable to us. And he's actually putting in chance of the gaps. Maybe we ought to wait for more information on that. And so I'll just close with a little illustration from Norman Geisler. The theist and the atheist walk into the woods, they find a little ball. So the theist says, okay, little ball, it must have a cause. The atheist agrees. They find a bigger ball, must have a cause. The atheist agrees. They find a ball the size of the planet Earth, must have a cause. The atheist agrees. Then they find a ball the size of the universe, and the theist says, well, it must have a cause. The atheist says, no, it's just there.
Okay, well, there's a lot to respond to there, a lot of different things. I can comment on a couple of them real quickly before I continue with some of the things I was saying earlier about the initial presentation. Number one, let me take some of the easy ones here. The Chinese and the Soviets that were referred to and the horrible reign of terror and death that was caused by those societies, fully acknowledge that. But I would also say that forced atheism is no better than forced religion. I would not endorse any society that forces people to be atheists. I'm not in favor of that. I mean, I don't want to live in Iran or Iraq any more than I want to live in a society that forces me to believe something that they want me to believe. And Hitler, a lot of times people say, well, Hitler was an atheist. And you know, that's why all these people were killed, because he had these atheistic beliefs and so on. And again, well, I think one of the things we would have, actually, Hitler was not. I think Hitler changed over and over again. I have a little quote here from Hitler, because I know that people quote Hitler all the time to support his atheistic views. And Hitler's comments in 1922. Were, my feeling as a Christian points me to my Lord and Savior as a fighter. It points me to the man who, once in loneliness, surrounded by a few followers, recognized the Jews for what they really were and summoned them to fight against them, and so on and so on. And he was citing great support for Jesus as somebody who fought against the Jews. And so Hitler, let's acknowledge one thing, Hitler was crazy. You know, he wasn't. I'm not going to pin him on you, but I don't expect to have him pinned on me either. So, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you. Good, thank you. But however, let me ask one other thing. It's always cited that Hitler killed 6 million Jews during World War II in the concentration camps. Any reasonable person is going to agree with that. The president of Iran apparently doesn't, but any reasonable person is going to agree with that. But Hitler, whereas was the leader and probably the policy setter for that country, didn't really kill 6 million people himself. He didn't go to the gas chambers and kill those people. He didn't go to the firing squads and kill those people. Who did that? The people who were living in Germany did that. Who were those people? Well, they were the Lutherans and the Calvinists who did that. You know, so don't, you know, Hitler was crazy, there's no doubt. But people who were willing to follow him were, many of them were Christians who believed in the absolute values of thou shalt not kill and the moral imperatives of that religion. So don't point the finger without recognizing that everybody bore some responsibility for that. The Catholics bore responsibility for it, and other Christians as well in World War II, and they generally acknowledge that. So Hitler was awful and a scourge, but he wasn't alone. So anyway, going back, well, that's, let me see. Blaise, the comment that Phil made, that Blaise Pascal said that death is our enemy. And as a humanist, I don't believe that's true. I don't think that death is our enemy. Death is a natural part of life. It's a natural occurrence. It happens to all living things, and it's not something that should be feared. I'm going to divert from my notes here for a minute and just tell you about a book that I read that had a very important impact on my life in taking me down this path. It's a book called On Death and Dying. It's by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. It was written around 1970. And it's the book, whereas you may not be familiar with the title or the author, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the concept of the book, which is that she, as a psychiatrist, observed in people who were terminally ill the fact that they go through these five stages of coping with their terminal illness: anger, bargaining, denial, depression, and acceptance. And as I read through the book, I was so involved in this reading of this book that I felt almost like I was going through these stages myself, you know, because you read these stories of these people, and it was very involving. I highly recommend it. It's a very interesting book. But when you come out the other end, you realize that death is not the worst thing. Living a meaningless life is the worst thing. And living an unimportant life is the worst thing. And getting to the end and realizing that you had this one opportunity and you didn't take advantage of it, that's the worst thing. That's worse than death. And as I thought more and more about this book and these five stages of coping, I realized that we are actually all terminal. You know, we all have to face our end at some point. And we know that. Deep in our subconscious, we know that this is true. And so we all live our lives in one of these stages of coping with our terminal nature. We all live in one of those stages. Whether we are, you can look around and see people who are in the denial stage. It's very easy, generally teenagers, they drive recklessly, they engage in wild behaviors, they take up smoking. And when you say to them, smoking can kill you, they say, it's not going to kill me for years, It's like, I got plenty of time, So people that engage in high-risk activities like, bungee jumping and so on, these people are living in denial of their mortality, right? People who live, people like Camus or Nietzsche, who were so depressed about life and thought it was so awful, they're coping with their terminal nature by being depressed. And from my perspective, people who are involved in religion are simply coping with their mortality by making a little bargain. They say, if I behave and I follow these rules, then I'm going to get a cookie at the end. I get ultimate, victory or whatever you want to call it. But it's a kind of a behavioral modification thing. If I do this, I get a cookie. And so, and that's a bargain that you make to cope with the fact that you are terminal, right? And people who are atheists or humanists come to grips with the fact that the acceptance of our mortality. I understand that this is the only life I have, and so therefore it's imperative that I live it in a way that is going to have the greatest impact. And I know when I use words like meaning and value in life, Phil is going to say, where do you derive that value from? Where do you derive that meaning from? We together as a community, and through the last several thousand years, have all contributed to an understanding of what morality is. Again, morality is a natural phenomenon. It's a natural state of humanity. We've evolved culturally to understand morality, and we benefit from morality. That's where we get it from. We get it from our common experience, from thousands of years of literature and art and religion. All of this contributes to our understanding of what is right and what is wrong. We see a lot of good, we see a lot of bad, and we know how to make a decision. And how do we know that? We know that because we have intelligence. How do we get intelligence? Intelligence, Phil again says, we can't have intelligence without an intelligent being. But it's not true. Evolution, natural selection, accounts for every bit of our intelligence. I would highly recommend a book written by Carl Sagan called The Dragons of Eden. It's a wonderful book, and it explains the evolution in very simple terms, the evolution of human intelligence. This information is very accessible. If you don't want to know it, you don't have to. You can choose to not know it. But it's out there, and you might find it very interesting. So, am I done? Okay. I'm not going to get nearly through all this stuff tonight, but thank you for listening.
Okay, I want to go back to the beginning just for a minute here, back to the beginning of the universe, back to the beginning of my opening statement. I argued that just about everybody agrees right now the universe had a beginning. Okay, so what's more, if the universe had a beginning, what's more reasonable? Atheism, that the universe popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause, or that something caused the universe to come into existence? I think on the beginning of the universe, theism is more reasonable. The continuing existence of the universe. I mean, if we couldn't bring about the beginning of our existence, how are we going to sustain ourselves in existence? I think theism is more reasonable than atheism. The design and order found in the universe. Okay? Again, I think theism is more reasonable than atheism. I haven't heard Jim on any one of these points. All he's saying is, just trust me, evolution through natural selection has explained all of these things. I beg to differ. That's what this debate is about. Okay? And to be totally honest with you, when it comes to to evolution, there has been, look at all the unproven assumptions of evolution. They've proven gradual change within a species, okay? They have an unproven assumption that either the universe is eternal, most evolutionists don't believe that anymore, or the universe popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause. That's assumed, not proved. That life came from non-life without intelligent intervention. Assumed, not proven. Intelligence came from non-intelligence. Assumed, not proved. Multicelled animals from single-celled animals. Assumed, not proved. Vertebrae from invertebrate. Assumed, not proved. Common ancestry of fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals. No, we have no transitional forms. No undisputed transitional forms in the fossil record. When you add all these unproven assumptions up, you know what they spell? They spell evolution. Evolution itself is an unproven assumption. Okay? Now, he talks about, you know, the desire for there to be life after death. I think there's also a desire for there not to be a God. Okay? There's this thing, human autonomy. We want to be our own kings. We don't want to have to answer to authority. So, yes, you can accuse the Christian of wishful thinking, but you can also accuse the atheist of wishful thinking. So what do? We look at the evidence. And when we look at the evidence of evolution, the evidence, supposed evolution, evidence for evolution, to quote my new friend, the emperor, has no clothes. So, and all these things, our moral experience, he keeps saying, you know, best, better, and that we just evolve this morality. Well, basically, based on that, atheism has nothing to bring to the table. I agree with him. Adolf Hitler was bad. Adolf Hitler was evil. But you can't get that from, well, morality just kind of evolved. And this is where it's at right now. Well, Adolf Hitler was a firm believer in evolution. He's not an atheist. He was actually a neo-pagan. He was a member of the Thule Society, the German branch of the Theosophical Society, founded by Helena Blavatsky. He was searching for the lost continent of Atlantis, and he believed Jesus was the greatest Aryan male who ever lived. And he wanted to bring about the next stage in human evolution, where the Aryan race had to be kept from pollution from other races. Okay? Adolf, how does the atheist say, well, you're wrong? Because evolution produced my nice morality. Adolf Hitler would look you in the face and say, my evolution produced my kind of morality. And I think that what's best for the world is that we remove all non-Aryans. Now, the Christian worldview can condemn that. Now, he talked about probably the indifferent and even the people who professed to be Christians who weren't really Christians in Germany and stuff like that. What he failed to say, though, is that Hitler killed over 20 million people. 6 million were Jews. And let it be known, that was every Jew that Adolf Hitler could get his nasty hands on. It was horrible what he did. But who were the other 14 million people that he killed? Who were the other million, tens of millions of people who were in concentration camps? Most of them professed to be Christians. And they were put in concentration camps because they did what Corrie ten Boom did. Because they knew there are certain things that are absolutely wrong and absolutely right. And they knew that human beings were created in God's image, so they risked their lives to save innocent Jewish people. So yeah, are there people who profess to be Christians that mess up? Yeah, all the time. But let's not also, you know, all you got to do is look at Adolf Hitler's Gestapo letters, his letters to the Gestapo. He feared the church in Germany. But he knew that you can't beat them, join them, so he gave a lot of pro-Christian propaganda. But when you look at each one of these things, true meaning in life, I mean, he's talking about live a meaningful life. What? Live a meaningful life and cease to exist for all eternity? I mean, how much meaning does Bertrand Russell's life have right now? A lot of people say, well, in his followers, what good does that do him? If he's right, he ceased to exist. If he's wrong, he's not very comfortable. Okay? What good did it do him? I mean, just make a meaningful life. What's a meaningful life? Adolf Hitler thought he was making a meaningful life. You need absolute moral laws to condemn the Osama bin Ladens. You need absolute moral laws to condemn the Adolf Hitlers, to condemn Nazi Germany. Atheism just does not have what it takes there. Okay? Personally, my own view of evolution, and I'm sure Jim would disagree with this, but it's either all men are created equal, creation, okay, And not everybody lives consistently with that who believes in God, or it's survival of the fittest. The strong survive. And that's the type of atheistic evolution the Chinese Marxist and the Soviet Union Marxist applied, and the neo-pagan Nazis as well. But in the Christian worldview, if, in fact, just in basic theism, there is such a thing as right and wrong. We can condemn the actions of individuals like Hitler. We can then condemn the actions of societies like the Taliban and Nazi Germany. And we can even condemn a world consensus. Atheists are always trying to convince more people to become atheists. Well, not always. Jim says he's not proselytizing. But atheists try to build the world, make the world a better place to live. They're judging the world by a standard that transcends the world. Where did that come from? Primordial soup? No. Prescriptive laws need a prescriber. This is more than just semantics. I am overjoyed that Jim is a moral human being, that he is a good guy, that he respects me, that he respects you. Okay? I am overjoyed about that. But if atheism is true, there's no way for nice guys like me and him to condemn the thugs and their actions like Adolf Hitler and Osama bin Laden. So our moral experience, theism, is more reasonable than atheism. The laws of logic, the laws of mathematics, could they evolve from matter? Free will and human responsibility. I mean, if only matter exists, then all our thoughts, our ideas, and our choices are just biologically determined. They're chemical reactions that occur inside our brain, and we can't be held morally responsible. But if we have non-material souls and we make those choices and then that acts upon the brain and then we get things rolling, then we can put people in prison for their actions, and they are responsible for their actions. So whatever the case, I don't think he's really touched my thesis, and that is on these different aspects of human experience, theism is more reasonable than atheism. All he does, he throws darts at my arguments. But a lot of those darts even look like Christian darts, because he's using worse and better and meaningful and things of that sort. I mean, just what he's saying cries out to me that there is a God. Now, I'll just close this rebuttal. Obviously, we're both running out of time. But Jim's raised issues I don't have time to address. I've raised issues he probably doesn't have time to address. But let me just say this. Blaise Pascal, when he talked about wagering your life on God, okay? He wasn't asking you to throw out your brains. Okay? What Blaise Pascal was saying was that if you seek God with all your heart, if you wager your life on God, you seek God, okay? If you win everything. If you lose nothing. Okay? But if you wager your life against God and you win nothing. If he's right, if we're in a car and we're driving, we get an accident, we both die, if he's right, he can't even turn to me and say, see, I told you. There's nothing to gain by that. But yet, if he's wrong, there's everything to lose. Blaise Pascal, what he's basically saying is, if there's just a small possibility of God existing, the wise man will seek him and will look for evidence to see if there is evidence for him. If your child was missing in the woods, and you found out there was only, the searchers came and said there's only a 1% chance that your child is still alive, is it all right if we call off the search? What are you going to say? Say, no, if there's any chance my child is still alive, there's so much to gain by continuing the search. Continue the search. There is so much to gain by continuing the search for God. And I would urge you to seek him.
We're going to take a 5-minute break. Please be back here as soon as possible.
Well, thank you for all coming back. That was good. We must be doing something here. Well, I would like to, I only have a couple of minutes, so I'm going to continue to focus on this idea of, which I think is very important, of the source of moral values. And again, this idea that's perpetuated that only Christianity can offer, through this Bible, any notion of absolute, unchanging, unerring moral values. And we don't see it. It's not there. Because the idea that these are not changing, well, frankly, this is like the law. We don't want the law to stay the same and be the same way all the time forever. We have to live in a world where laws can change and where people can affect what happens in their lives. Otherwise, we wouldn't have anything like the Magna Carta or the U.S. Constitution. And so moral law is like that. As societies change, as people grow and learn, again, slavery is a perfect example. There was a time in history when slavery was acceptable. And it was not only acceptable, it was endorsed by these absolute, unchanging moral values. And all through history, you know, the history of the Jewish, the Judeo-Christian tradition, it was endorsed. The same thing is true, really, of thou shalt not kill, right? I mean, that thou shalt not kill is a pretty simple thing to understand. But all throughout the Old Testament, there are plenty of examples. When Joshua fit the battle at Jericho, right? You know, what did God tell him to do when the battle was all over? Go in and slay all the men, women, and children who were left over. Well, this was the same God who said, thou shalt not kill. These are not absolute moral values that we get from the Bible. We don't need a God to tell us that killing is a bad thing for humanity. You know, again, referring to something that Phil said, again, I think that there are just great misunderstandings, and I think at times willful misunderstandings of evolution and how it works and why it works. But the idea that Phil mentioned, I think, is an example of how this is often misunderstood. Evolution, fueled by natural selection, is survival of the fittest. He said that, and that's correct. It is not survival of the strongest. There's a big difference between being a fit society and being a strong society. And it may be a subtle difference to some people, but being moral people and having moral laws that we all agree are correct makes us a fit society. Where do we get that? We get that because we have learned through bad experiences, and this is something we can experience. We don't need a God to tell us what morality is really comes down to. What is it that we see that benefits people the most? We have great eyes and ears and brains that can interpret what has happened in the past and what is happening right now and what benefits us the most. That is the source of morality. And so we can make that decision. If it was determined, here's a question you can ask yourselves. If it was determined today that God does not exist, that it's an absolute proven fact that God does not exist, would you go out and kill somebody that you didn't like, or would you go out and steal or rob a bank or create mayhem? If the answer is yes, then you're probably an immoral person anyway. If the answer is no, then that proves that you don't need God in order to be good. We get benefits ourselves from being good. That is, that we get to live, by being good, we get to live in a ordered and calm and predictable society. That's a good thing that we get, simply by understanding from common experience what is good and what is not. We don't need God to tell us that. Okay, let's see. Which one of these do I want to say in 1 minute? I don't have any that are going to last 1 minute. it'll take me 1 minute to find the one I want. Chance is not the same. Phil referred several times to chance. Chance is, and anti-evolutionists use this all the time, chance is not the same as natural selection. Yeah, again, if you want to learn and understand something about evolution, please understand that chance is not the same as natural selection. Who wants to see, by the way, a perfect example of how evolution works. You can see it right in your own life. Everybody does this. We're doing it here tonight. The answer is, Phil made the reference earlier to an explosion in a print shop, or when you walk out of the room, you see a Scrabble tile on the board, and you see that written language, or people often refer to the works of Shakespeare don't happen by themselves. But those are written manifestations of oral speech, of language, right? Language is a perfect example of how evolution works. When the first humanoid uttered the first grunt to somebody else, and that grunt carried a meaning to that other person, and that person was able to act and understand on that meaning, that did not anticipate the works of Shakespeare. It evolved into hundreds or thousands of different languages over time, and to the language that we speak today. Language is a perfect example that we can all grasp. Think about how language works. It's not the Tower of Babel. The reason we speak different languages is because language evolved just the same way through trial and error. There are lots of languages that no longer exist. There are words that we use now that we didn't use before. Everything about it is a perfect metaphor and example, not a metaphor, it's an actual working example of how evolution works. And I guess I'll probably wrap up. You know. The museums, if you go to the Museum of Natural History anywhere, they're full of examples of transitional fossils. You know, Darwin talked about the fact that there were no transitional fossils, but that was 150 years ago. The museums are full of examples. Think of the whale as a good one.
I'm talking as I'm going away from the mic.
This is 5 minutes, right? Good. Okay, you talked about in the museums there's all these fossils of transitional forms, but many evolutionists still just don't see that, and so they formed a view, the late Stephen Jay Gould, punctuated equilibrium, which tries to explain why there are no real transitional forms, and they say that the transitional forms existed only long enough, maybe 20,000 to 100,000 years, only long enough to give rise to another major species or whatever, and then they just didn't live long enough to be fossilized. So all of a sudden we have evolutionists who believe in evolution despite acknowledging no missing links. And Stephen Jay Gould was no slouch. I think Jim implied, I could be wrong, but he seemed to imply contradictions in the Bible. Well, all I could say is that's really not relevant to the debate. We're not debating whether or not God wrote a book. But if you want to look into it, when critics ask, by Norman Geisler and Tom Howe, an excellent book, Gleason Archer's Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties would be a good place to go. Jim seems to miss the point on morality. He says you don't need God to be good. And I mean, you know, we were created by him, but if you don't believe in him, yeah, lots of atheists like Jim can be very moral people. But he's missing the point. I'm not arguing you need God to be good. I'm arguing without God, there's no basis from which to draw a distinction between good and evil. I'm saying, as a Christian, I have the right, as a Christian, within my worldview, I'm perfectly consistent with it to call the actions of Hitler or Osama bin Laden evil. I am glad that Jim calls them evil, but I don't know what basis he has for that. He says our moral notions evolved. I really don't know what he's talking about there. He says chance is not the same thing as natural selection. Well, you've got a selection going on without a selector. If it's not random, if it's not chance, I don't know what it is, okay? You know, nobody's doing the selecting. He says language evolved. Well, language is an expression of our thoughts. And we get right back to the problem. What is the thought? Is the thought just a chemical exchange that occurs inside somebody's brain? Or is there a human soul that decides, I want to do this or I want to do that? Because if all a thought is just a chemical reaction and is biologically determined, then we can't condemn Adolf Hitler's actions. Let's see. Tonight you got two frustrated guys up here trying to refute in less time all the objections we raised. But he mentioned the United States Constitution says you can't teach religion in schools. Well, number one, it really doesn't teach that. And if you read the Constitution closely, which it doesn't seem like Republicans or Democrats really care about doing anymore, but if you read it closely, The Constitution doesn't really mention education. Now, Marx and Engels, they talk about the state controlling education. And Plato, he wanted the state to control education. But our founding fathers believed that was something to be left. Tenth Amendment, whatever power is not spelled out for the federal government, automatically pull back to the people and the states respectively. So that was a local issue. In other words, if the local community is Buddhist, you'd expect them to start a Buddhist school. If they're a Christian, you expect them to start a Christian school. And if the Buddhist kid didn't like it, his family would send them to a Buddhist community to go to school there. The founding fathers wanted us to have the decisions. They didn't want some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. deciding what curriculum your kid is going to go through. The founding fathers knew if the government controlled education, it would be indoctrination. So the founding fathers would not want religion taken out of the schools. Okay? I mean, they opened their sessions in prayer. They wouldn't want religion taken out of schools. What they would want is the state taken out of the schools. I mean, the state is not doing a very good job since it's taken over public education, by the way. But the founding fathers wanted us to decide. Now, he talks about taking religion out of the schools. Here's a quote. Nothing human is alien to the religious. Nothing human is alien to the religious. That's from Humanist Manifesto number 1, 1933. Now, the humanists have changed their argumentation, but they used to admit that secular humanism was a faith. Then they realized they weren't getting enough mileage out of it, so now they say it's not a faith. But what I'm saying is, I firmly believe, and I don't mean this as an insult in any way, that man over there, Jim Corbett, is just as religious as Phil Fernandez is. If he wasn't as religious as me, he wouldn't be here taking this debate. If he didn't believe it with passion in his beliefs and allow his beliefs to give him some semblance of what a meaningful life is, he wouldn't be here tonight. Okay? So the issue is, you know, it shouldn't be get the state out of the schools. Let the people decide in their communities. Okay, 1 minute. Let's see. He said we're moral beings because we evolved that way. That begs the question. That really begs the question. He says there's nothing better for a community than a. I stopped taking notes there. Well, like I say, why is survival of humanity a good thing? I think it's a good thing. But he keeps saying good, better, worse. He's using all these words as if there's some standard above all individuals, above all societies, and above any world consensus. That only makes sense if there's an absolute moral law above all individuals, all societies, and in world consensus. And that only makes sense if there's an absolute moral lawgiver above all individuals, all societies, and any world consensus.
Well, first off, to start out, I just want to say thank you to everybody, to Phil for being a terrific guy to have this discussion with, to Mark for doing a great job, and also to Rand, who's running around the back there. And I've worked with Rand a couple of times in these events through the Thought Life organization, and they always do a terrific job. And so I appreciate the opportunity to come and share these ideas. I don't have too much to say in conclusion. I just want to, you know, again, thank everybody. I pretty much said what I, you know, this is what I believe. I think it makes, the whole concept here is there a creator? And I think that as we go forward in time, we will find that there is less and less information, less and less reason to believe, as we get more and more information, less and less reason to believe that there is a God. I often liken this to the time, a situation like the time of St. Paul, okay, kind of ironically. At the time of St. Paul, he was, I'm using the term St. Paul because I'm showing my Catholic background here, probably to you it's just Paul, but anyway, he lived at a time when he was trying to promote a brand new idea, right? And he took something that was very different than anybody had ever believed before. He really is, I think, more than anybody and I think many people here will probably agree, more than anybody, responsible for the development of the Christian religion out of the Jewish religion. And but it took, as he went around to these different communities and shared his ideas, of course he couldn't do very much in Israel, because, or in Palestine, I guess at that time, because they would have stoned him for being a blasphemer, you know, for saying that God had a son. They didn't believe that at all. The Jews don't believe that. So he had to go someplace else, and he went off into the pagan world, and he preached what he did, and he got his message out there. But it took 300 years before, from the time of Paul to the time of Constantine, when Constantine was actually converted, so to speak, to Christianity, which he did for political reasons more than religious reasons. But when he converted, that was the time. From that point forward, Christianity took really root and had a foothold and never really looked back. It really became the official religion from that point forward, right? But it took 300 years for that to happen. And we're living in a time kind of like that. In 1849, Darwin introduced a new idea. And just like what Paul said, you know, when he went out and preached his new message, there was a great deal of resistance, so much so that he and many other people were killed, as you all know those stories. And so there was a tremendous amount of resistance to this new idea, as there often is to any new idea. And when Darwin introduced his new idea in 1849, there has been a tremendous amount of resistance to taking that idea. Now, certainly, there are plenty of places where it is taking root in the scientific community as we learn more and more and more, but among the Christian community, there is a great deal of resistance. But I think, just like any new idea, it's going to take time for people to get comfortable with it and to understand it and to come to grasp it. And if it takes 300 years for we've been at this, or the idea of evolution has been available for about 150 years right now, and it will take time for people to understand it and to appreciate what it is, but it will happen, because as we gain more knowledge, as Mark has said, as we gain more knowledge in exponentially greater chunks and mouthfuls, we will be forced to face the reality that evolution through natural selection is the way of the world. It's as simple as that. And we might not be alive when it is fully embraced, but it will be. It's coming. And I think that people should look at it and say, what can we do to take the very good things that are in religion and use those in a world where religion will be a thing of the past? So anyway, I know you don't want to hear that, but that's, I honestly believe that's true. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll be interested to hear any questions later.
Yeah, again, this discussion has been a delight, and meeting Jim, I've made a new friend, and you've been a real gentleman, as you name gentleman, Jim Corbett. I don't know if anybody knows the fighter, but he's been a real gentleman and a scholar, and I really appreciate that. Now, he's saying that eventually we're all going to, the society's going to eventually come of age and embrace evolution. That's not really what's happening. Christianity today is growing at a faster rate than any other time in the history of Christianity. We just don't see it on CNN because it's happening in third world countries. These are people that don't have a lot of political clout and things of that sort. Atheism seems to be on the decline in academic circles. There are more and more Wiccan professors, neo-pagan. You know, America and Europe, Christianity's in decline, but so is atheism. It seems that seems to me, if I'm reading things correctly, neo-paganism is on the rise. And I think that's what Paul meant, that when you reject the existence of the invisible God as proven through nature, the end result is really not atheism. The end result will be man bowing down before statues of four-legged creatures, and that seems to be the direction America is going, in a neo-pagan direction. I just want to comment, he talked about the Bible promoting slavery. No, slavery was already in existence, and God just gave certain commands for a more humane usage of it. But actually, in Paul's writings, he condemns kidnapping. He says, anyone who takes part in kidnapping shall not inherit the kingdom of God. The word for kidnapping there in the Greek was the official word for the slave trade back in his day. Western civilization, as it embraced Christianity, did not invent slavery. But when it came of age, it abolished slavery. Go to countries where Christianity has never had a big impact, slavery is still the name of the game. In fact, many Islamic regimes where Christianity never was strong in that culture, you could still have people being sold into slavery on an alarming rate. Jim appears to teach that slavery is absolutely wrong. I would agree with him, but his worldview can't produce moral absolutes. He talks about Carl Sagan and that natural selection accounts for intelligence. Carl Sagan was part of the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He stated one message, just one message from outer space, would prove intelligent life on other planets. However, apparently, 30,000 volumes worth of information in a single-celled animal, that just got here by chance. So I don't think he was as unbiased as he may have thought. Now, Jim Corbett is morally outraged at the evil in the world, but he has no ultimate basis for moral outrage. I would argue either human rights come from God, an absolute moral lawgiver, an absolute good standard, and they're inalienable, or they come from human governments and can be taken away. Now, he may not like it, but it seems to me that evolution is read in tooth and nail, and it does create a situation where the Adolf Hitlers and the... I'm not blaming people like Jim and who holds his form of atheism. But once you lose the worldview basis for absolute morality, there's always going to be an Adolf Hitler or a Osama bin Laden waiting in the wings. Well, bin Laden's a whole other issue. In fact, that would be Islam. He actually is an absolutist, but I would say he's absolutely wrong. But basically what I've stated today is this, that, which view is more reasonable, atheism or theism? When you look at the beginning of the universe, the continuing existence of the universe, the design and order found in the universe, our moral experience, meaning in life, the laws of logic and mathematics, free will and moral responsibility, and human rights, in each case, theism is more reasonable than atheism. If man is mere molecules in motion, then there is no basis for human rights, meaning in life, moral responsibility, moral laws, the laws of logic and mathematics. And so in each case, I would argue that belief in God is more reasonable than the rejection of belief in God. And I don't think Jim, as great of a guy as he is, I don't think he showed in any one of those cases, beginning of the universe, moral laws, absolute truth, where it's more atheism is a more reasonable explanation than theism. I think if there's gaps, going on, it's not a God of the gaps, it's a chance of the gaps. God bless you.
We're going to have Rand walking around with a handheld mic, and I'd like you to please speak into the mic so everybody can hear. If it doesn't happen that everybody can hear, then he'll repeat the question. You don't have a handheld mic. Well, yes, you do. Okay. And the way it's going to work is you'll direct your question either to Jim or to Phil, and then they will have a chance to respond 2-3 minutes, and then you would have a chance to respond also. So both of them will have a chance to respond to the questions, but please direct it toward one or the other.
Hello. I actually have a question for each of you. First one is for Phil. Okay, you said that if God exists, Mother Teresa will be rewarded for all her good deeds, and that Hitler would be punished. So if Teresa was rewarded and Hitler was punished, what about Gandhi or Buddha or Muhammad? They were all great people. But they did not accept the same point of view as Christianity. They were not Christians. Would they go to hell? Would they be punished?
Do you want me to go to the microphone? Or?
Yeah, it's probably best. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's an outstanding question. And of course, now we're stepping a little bit outside. I probably brought it on myself. We're stepping a little bit outside. Does God exist? Into the issue of who goes to heaven. And the Bible teaches, I would say Gandhi did many good things, and there are, certainly I have neighbors who are not Christians, who are really, really good people in my book. Jim is a great guy in my book, and I've only known him for a few hours. Okay? See, what Christianity teaches, and again, I'm stepping a little bit out of the debate, does God exist? But I'm stepping a little bit out of it right now. What does Christianity teach? Christianity teaches that Phil Fernandez's book doesn't amount to a hill of beans. It's God's book. And the Bible teaches that God is absolutely holy, and He cannot forgive sin unless it's been paid for in full. But then God loves us so much that He slaughtered His Son Jesus in our place. And so, and then He offers us the free gift of salvation, but He's a loving God. He's not going to force us to accept this ultimately worthy substitute sacrifice who atoned for our sins. We have the freedom to accept or reject His salvation and His forgiveness by accepting or rejecting Jesus. I know that's not going to satisfy everybody. It satisfied me in my search for truth.
Well, I don't. That's not really a question that I ponder all that much because I think that Gandhi and in a way, the beauty of Gandhi is that his life has meaning for all of us because we can learn so much. Did Gandhi have a meaningful life? Yeah, because look what he was able to do. He lived a very positive life. But even after he's gone, his legacy of learning of how to treat other people and of the dignity of human beings is tremendous. All for generations and generations, everybody will always, know about Gandhi. It's like I came here tonight with the idea of talking about Socrates, and can we have Phil had mentioned earlier in the evening about our that an atheist cannot offer hope, and what meaning can an atheist offer in life? Well, this is getting a little off your question, but the hope that an atheist can offer is the hope that I can have a meaningful life in terms of impacting other people in my community, my family, in my world, and that others that come after me will learn something from my experience here. And everybody can learn something wonderful from Gandhi. So, I don't believe there's a heaven where Gandhi goes, but I believe that Gandhi's life is just a great example to all of us, and it's a wonderful human experience. And from that, we can use that to help to form our moral values. That's what I meant before when I said through thousands of years of learning from one another, especially people like Gandhi. I mean, that's Gandhi's reward, is that we learn from him. So it's a great thing. I love the question. Thank you.
My other question is directed for you, actually. You said that Christians try to sell their point of view and use the Bible verse as well.
When you say sell, you mean kind of pitch that, promote that, yeah.
Well, do you not also try to do the same thing, so you don't try to pitch your own point of view? Because you also said at the end of your first statement, you're trying to make it so we can all get along a little bit. Is that not doing
anything? Right. I'm not, I don't have a mission to go out and promote my view. I mean, I'm here tonight, because I want to represent my view, but I don't have a mission to go knock on people's doors or send missionaries out to all around the world or all around the globe to try to encourage them to become like me. There's a great distinction. I have to tell you that I think that one of the most unfortunate parts of the New Testament is the part where they say, go out and make all disciples of the world, because that's when religions start to clash. And, all the conflicts we have in the world, probably 80% of them are religious conflicts, whether they're Christianity against Islam, Christianity against Jews against Islam, Christians against Christians, you know, if you look all around the world, what's going on right now, what's going on through history, are because people are going out trying to say, my God's better than your God. And you know, if you're not believing in my God, then my God says, I've got to kill you, you know. So you're an infidel, I've got to kill you, you know. So unfortunately, that's one of the downsides of the way people interpret religions. So, but I'm not, you know, again, I don't have an agenda. I don't have an afterlife to sell you. So, you know, you have to, you just have to take it as it is. You know, this is life, and we all have to get along. And so, you know, we're all dependent. As I did say earlier, we are dependent beings. I fully acknowledge that. But we're dependent on one another to get along. Survival of the fittest. I don't know if I made a note on this. I don't know if I said it yet or not, but survival of the fittest is not the same thing as survival of the strongest. I think I did say that. Anyway, does that answer your question at all? Okay.
I have a question for Jim. How has mercy and forgiveness been a product of natural selection?
Terrific. You know, there is a website called forgiveness.com, right? If you go there, what you will see is scientific studies that prove that forgiveness is actually more beneficial from a psychological standpoint to the person who forgives than the person who receives the forgiveness. It's a wonderful website, and if you actually is part of my the reason I went there was because I think Mark mentioned earlier that I wrote a book called Life and the Meaning of Golf, right? And, you know, I don't know how many people here like to play golf, but one of the things in golf is when you get a mulligan, you know, anybody know what a mulligan is? It's when you hit a bad shot and you take another one without taking a stroke for it, you know, and everybody in your group says, all right, whatever, you know, go ahead, hit another one. And and I use that as sort of a metaphor for forgiveness. But the idea is that forgiveness is a very healing thing. But it's more healing for the person who forgives. Again, goodness and badness is all judged by a very singular criteria. That is, how does it benefit humanity, either humanity as a whole or that human as an individual or, you know, the community? But forgiveness is a very beneficial thing to everybody, the person who forgives and the forgivee, okay? So that would be my view of that. Same thing, right? And, you know, I mean, I feel best when I have done something for somebody else for the pure joy of doing something for somebody else. Now, I'm not looking for a reward for it. When I am able to do something right or do something good, how does that make me feel? It makes me feel great. I feel good about myself. I feel good about the world I live in. I mean, I can jump up and kick my heels together because it makes me feel good when I do that. That's a natural. I'm hardwired for that feeling. Okay, thanks.
Sure, I'd just like to say two things. As I stated earlier, Jim, I think he has an agenda, but he takes debates in defense of his views, but that's not an agenda. Well, if the Christian's got an agenda, you know, and by the way, I don't go door to door. Maybe I should, I don't know, but atheists may not go door to door, but it seems like they've been going school to school pretty good via the ACLU. But I think Jim's just as religious as I am. Mercy and forgiveness, he says that it helps better. Mercy and forgiveness helps better the person who does the forgiving. That just confirms the truth of Scriptures. Numerous passages, one from Proverbs, Solomon says, a heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. And the Bible teaches us to be merciful, to be forgiving, as our Lord is merciful and forgiving. And yeah, it does help the person, but I think that just confirms the truth of the Scriptures.
Okay, just one last quick comment on that. The Bible is not the only place that teaches mercy. There are lots of other religions and other philosophies of life that are not religious that teach that. The Buddha, 500 years before Christ, was teaching mercy and forgiveness in his part of the world. The Bible teaches nothing different than we can find in other places. So, again, where do we get all these experiences? From our common knowledge of what's good, what benefits people. I think Buddhism is a beautiful religion. It's a wonderful religion. It's got some great things that we can all learn. Mercy and forgiveness, key among those.
Yeah, this question is Phil. And I just want to take issue also with your claim that atheists and humanists have no basis for moral judgments other than what we borrow from Christianity. And I think that that's absolutely untrue. And in fact, I would argue that what passes for Christian morality today has been strongly shaped to fit into secular society shaped by humanism from the Renaissance on. But apart from that, humanist morality, the only real morality really worth having is based on our capacity for empathy and our collective sense of what it takes to live together. We know we just can't live together if we kill each other, if we steal from each other. And we have a collective sense of, and our collective sense and our collective memory of what's caused suffering. Suffering to neither, to innocent people. We can condemn it or on that basis. So the question is, why should we think that absolutes from God are necessary in face of, instead of, far more immediate, climate facing reasons for morality, and I guess I'll stop there.
Okay, yeah, you said that my statement that morality does not, that morality has to come from God, that it's absolutely untrue. So then I assume that you believe in absolute truth. You don't believe in that, so then my statement was not absolutely untrue. So you basically, you uttered a self...
It's impossible for a person to act morally with full belief that they're doing so, because God told them.
But your statement was that my statement was absolutely untrue, but then you just admitted that you don't believe in absolute truth. What's that?
There are some good teachings in Christianity,
but you do stand corrected when you stated that one of my statements was absolutely untrue. And then you admitted that you don't believe in absolute truth.
That humanists have no basis for moral judgment other than what we have somehow borrowed, taken over from Christianity. I think is absolutely untrue.
Well, yeah, but you can't say anything's absolutely untrue.
At least it is, more true.
I don't know if you... See, to say there is no absolute truth is a claim to know the truth, that there's not truth. I mean, you have a self-refuting world system, but I guess you can live with it. My basic point is, we were created in God's image, so even people from other religions, now there are differences between Buddhism and Christianity, obviously you're emphasizing some of the similarities. The Bible teaches, delight yourself in the Lord, he'll give you the desires of your heart. God gives us our desires. Buddha was all about extinguishing desire. Two totally different goals. Buddha was agnostic towards God's existence. So the religions aren't always the same. But man was created in God's image, according to Christianity, which means as image bearers of God, we will have those moral notions. Romans 2, 14 and 15, God has written his moral laws on our hearts, whether we're atheists, Christians, neo-pagans, whatever it may be, the question is, how did those moral notions get there? How did our moral conscience get there? Theism has the explanation. Atheism does not.
Again, obviously we have an ongoing disagreement about whether atheism can claim any right to moral judgments, and obviously we'll have to just agree to disagree on that. Clearly, evolution through natural selection has given us a culture and a belief system and a societal norm for moral behavior. I'd like to just comment on my observation of this whole idea of being created in God's image. And from my perspective, it's quite the opposite. Our gods are created in our image. Whether we are Hawaiian Islanders who create our gods in the volcanoes, or whether we are live in a jungle and we create our gods based on the trees and the rain, or whether we are people who live in different environments and create our gods based on that. If we were really created in the image of God, of the God that Phil is describing, why do we even need bodies at all? God is the spiritual being, and if we were truly created in the image of God, why do we need bodies? Why are we not spiritual beings that are in the image of God? We share, and everybody has a little different numbers on this, but we share roughly about 90-something percent of our DNA. By the way, I don't know if you noticed my DNA tie here tonight, but we share 90-something percent of our DNA with mice and with chimpanzees, and we share all of our bodily systems, our physical systems, our sensory system, our circulatory system, our central nervous system, our reproductive system, respiratory, digestive, all of these we share with all the other animals on this planet. And yet, the one thing that we can't see or prove or anything is our soul. This is the part that say, oh, well, because of that, we're created in God's image. We are just like all the other animals, except we have greater intelligence and a greater ability to know through our cultural experiences, as was just very articulately pointed out, thank you, what is right from wrong. So, God was created in our image.
Jim, I guess this question is for you. You touched on that you have a Catholic background.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could tell us, when did you adopt atheism and why?
Oh, I'd be happy to do that. I went to Catholic grammar school, I went to Catholic high school, and I went to a Catholic college. I grew up back east. And I started questioning. It was kind of an odd process. I mean, I was an altar boy. I was very devout. I wanted to be a priest when I was a kid. And I mentioned to Mark, we talked about this earlier. I'll just throw one thing out here. I know that Catholic priests have gotten an awful lot of bad press in the last several years, and rightfully so, by the way. I don't disagree with that. Those individuals have done some horribly devastating things. But in all the time that I spent in the company of priests as a young kid growing up, and it was quite a lot of time, I never experienced or observed anything other than the highest of ethical behavior and finest role models of people. So I don't want you to think that I'm one of these people who's just so angry at something that happened years ago. It was nothing like that at all. But I started questioning when I was in fourth grade, how could this possibly be? And again, Mark and I talked about this earlier. There was a kid in my class, Alex Rostin, who was a good friend of mine, lived in the neighborhood, a terrific shortstop, but he happened to be Jewish. And we were taught that unless, and Phil just kind of corroborated this, unless, because Gandhi can't get into heaven, Alex Rostin sure can't get into heaven. And I thought to myself as a kid that just the justice of that seems so wrong that here's this kid who, in order for him to get this great reward that I'm entitled to just because I'm part of the in crowd, I didn't make any decision to be Catholic. My parents made that for me. But just because I was part of the in crowd, I got to go to heaven, but this kid did not. In order for him to do that, he would have to completely turn against his family and all of their generations of their family and do something completely different. And that struck me as so incredibly unjust that I just started thinking about You know, I started questioning things. And later, when I was in high school, I can remember very clearly taking a class in anthropology. And are there any people here who are Catholic, by any chance? No. Okay. All right. Right. Same here. Right. But I remember taking an anthropology class, and in anthropology class, we were studying primitive societies. That's what they do in anthropology. And one of the things we learned was how they use magic in their religions. You know, again, African tribal societies, Hawaiian Islander societies, you know, those kind of things, and how they use magic in their religions. And okay, I get that. And then they would march us down the hall, and we'd go to Mass. And in Mass, they would say, well, this piece of bread is now the body of Jesus Christ. It's not a symbol of the body. This wine is the blood of Jesus Christ. It's not the symbol of the blood. It is actually the body and blood of Jesus, you know, through this miracle. I thought, well, wait a minute. Here we are ridiculing these people because they use magic, and we're doing the same thing. We're using magic in our religion. And it's all throughout. We have talking snakes, and we have boats with animals, and we have you know, all kinds of magic in our religion. And why is it magic when they do it, but a mystery when we do it? What's the difference? Well, the difference is only it's them versus us. We would never criticize what we do, because we've been doing it for 2,000 years, or 3,000, or 4,000, whatever. But what they do, that's magic. We criticize them and ridicule them, and then that started the more or less the rapid descent of my beliefs. Everything fell apart from there. I'd go to church, and you know, they would recite, I don't know how universal this is, but the creed, what's it called, the Nicene Creed, you know, I believe in this, I believe in that, and I would go down the list and say, well, you know, the virgin birth, and the resurrection, and all these different things. You know, these are all magic. This is the same thing that we criticize those people for, but we do it too. And all of a sudden I realized, I don't really believe in any of this. And so it was a very gradual process of realizing that we are no different than those primitive people who, in fact, you know, it occurs to me that Christianity is a religion based on human sacrifice. Human sacrifice is a pagan practice, and you know, but it is a religion based on human sacrifice. When I watched the movie, what's it called, The Passion of Christ, I walked out of there and I thought, what possible connection could there be between, between killing this person and the removal of our sins? Where's the connection here? I can't connect those dots. This is just magic. And I don't want to be too long-winded here, but I mean, all of a sudden, all this stuff starts coming through. You know that. I'll just leave it at that. You know, it's just, I had a thought there, but I just lost it. But anyway, it was a long, gradual process for me.
Sorry. We're allowed to respond to each one of the questions, so I'll respond to that question. And I also have a Roman Catholic background. I was raised by Joseph Fernandez and his wife, who was formerly known as Angelina Menachino. They were the children of Portuguese and Italian immigrants in New Jersey. I went to St. Al's Grammar School. I went to Essex Catholic High School in North New Jersey. But I became a skeptic in high school. I transferred to public school, and the public school is not teaching the same thing as the Catholic schools. And I had an atheist creative writing teacher, so I became a skeptic. But then it took about 3 years later, Marine Corps boot camp, and the Marine Corps itself was just so much more boring than my recruiter told me, and it led me to search for answers, and eventually I became a Christian. So I was really never really believed as a Roman Catholic. I would agree that the Roman Catholic view of the Lord's Supper, as a good Baptist, I would view that as magic, transubstantiation, where it literally becomes the body and blood of Christ that retains the appearance of bread and wine. But I think there's a big difference between miracles, God superseding natural laws, and the magic of pagan religions where they search for secret powers of nature and things of that sort. But I do want to comment, you mentioned about kind of a little bit on the subject of tolerance without using the word. I just want to state that traditional tolerance meant freedom of religion and freedom of speech. Traditional tolerance meant that I have the right to tell my Muslim neighbor, if you don't accept Jesus, you're going to hell. And he had the right to tell me, if you don't submit to Allah, you're going to hell. We had that freedom. And then, but then I don't want to see him locked up if he doesn't break any laws. He doesn't want to see me locked up if I don't break any laws. But me and my wife and him and his wife, we could break bread and have some food and argue all night long. That's what traditional tolerance was. Freedom of religion and freedom of speech. The new tolerance is not tolerant, though. The new tolerance is all beliefs are equally true and all behavior is equally wholesome. And if you don't agree with us, we can't tolerate it.
Okay, I think we have one more question, and
gentlemen here. Mine is for Jim. This is in regard to your statement that language is a big example of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'd like to submit that it did not come by chance, rather than it came by intelligent humans creating and the written and spoken language. Mm-hmm. So my question would be, would you not agree that language and written word is really intelligent design and not?
No, I agree with you completely that it did not come about by chance. The reason that language is such a perfect example of evolution in progress at work is because it comes by the process of natural selection. Again, this is the perfect example of why the tornado in the junkyard in the 747 doesn't work. That metaphor of the tornado assumes that something goes from a pile of junk to a complete 747. The process of evolution is one of gradual mutation and change over time, selecting for those things that work the best. And language, if two people are grunting at each other, but those sounds communicate an intelligent thought, and they benefit from that, in that they caught the animal that they were hunting, or that they were able to avoid a danger that they were threatened by, then that thought and that expression will be retained and move on. And the ability for them to communicate that and share that with their neighbors, benefits everybody. And that's how it starts to grow. And then over the course of time, I mean, look how many, evolution is full of dead ends and trial and error and things that didn't work. And look at, that's exactly what happens with language. How many dead languages are there throughout the course of history where people in communities had this language but they don't exist anymore, or they got subsumed by another culture and so their language was absorbed. Look at the English language. It's full of German, old Saxon language, and American Indian language. We're dramatically impacted by the fact that our American English is impacted by the Portuguese and the Italian immigrants. In the most positive way. And the Irish immigrants from my family and on and on and on. That is evolution at work. You don't go from a grunt that says, look out, you're going to step off the cliff, to the works of Shakespeare or to the Bible. You have to go through, and the written work of Shakespeare is only a physical manifestation of that language. We communicate through oral language. We have been smart enough to figure a way to represent that in print, but it is definitely, without doubt, it is evolution in action. So I would really assert that it is.
Jim agreed that language did not come by chance, but that's what evolutionists do. They replace the word chance with evolution, natural selection, and then they act like, well, we solved the problem. No. There's no selector. So natural selection, it's all random. It's all chance. He talks about Hoyle with Gramercy not understanding evolution. They were two of Great Britain's most eminent scientists, and they were evolutionists. They weren't talking about time, that the amount of time that it would take for tornado to go through junkyard. They weren't talking about time, they were talking about probabilities. They know evolution takes billions of years, but even with that in their knowledge, they said that still the chances of evolution occurring over a period of 15 to 18 billion years and producing just single life, simple life, is the same chance as a tornado randomly running through a junkyard and producing the Boeing 747. These guys were aware of the time factor, and they still said that's the chance of life evolving from non-life. Whatever the case, he uses the word benefit, you know, what benefits us. Look, lots of people like the Adolf Hitlers have done evil things that have benefited them. Okay? How do we have the right to call their actions wrong? Only if there are absolute moral laws above all individuals, above all societies, and the world consensus. But then that necessitates the absolute moral law giver.
Hello. Okay. I think that's it for tonight. Why don't we give them a round of applause for the time.